U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed back to the Middle East.
He will discuss specific steps parties can take, including how they can use their influence with others in the region to avoid escalation.
A generation of child amputees is emerging in Gaza.
I used to run and play. I was so happy with my life. But now, when I lost my leg, my life became ugly, and I got sad.
And smaller, faster, stronger. A new material for semiconductors will revolutionize all of your electronics.
So this is really a paradigm shift. It's a different way of doing electronics.
Today is Friday, January 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed back to the Middle East to visit multiple countries, including Israel, amid rising fears that the conflict is spreading. Tensions have surged between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah after a deputy Hamas leader was killed in Beirut on Tuesday. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
With the war between Israel and Hamas nearly 3 months old, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is returning to the Middle East late Thursday. It is his fourth visit since Hamas launched a surprise attack on Israel on October 7th, killing 1,200 Israelis. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller had this announcement Thursday.
Over the course of the next week, the secretary will visit Turkey, Greece, Jordan, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the West Bank, and Egypt for meetings with foreign counterparts and others.
Fears of the Israel-Hamas conflict spreading into a regional war have grown after the targeted killing of Hamas Deputy Chief Saleh al-Aruri in Lebanon on Tuesday, an attack that Israel has neither confirmed nor denied that it carried out. Miller said Blinken will work to calm tensions.
He will focus on, as he has consistently since October 7th, preventing the conflict from expanding. He will discuss specific steps parties can take, including how they can use their influence with others in the region to avoid escalation. It is in no one's interest, not Israel's, not the region's, not the world's, for this conflict to spread beyond Gaza.
Israel had vowed to eliminate Hamas leaders after the October 7th attack and says its forces at its northern border with Lebanon are on high alert. President Joe Biden has come under heavy criticism for his strong support of Israel's right to defend itself after the attack, as more than 22,000 Palestinians have been reported as killed by Israel in Gaza since the war began. Experts say critics often have unrealistic expectations about how much influence Biden or Blinken has on Israel's decisions on how to conduct the war. Brian Katulis is vice president for policy at the Middle East Institute. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
There's this myth that the United States has some magic button or lever that if we simply just cut off the delivery of shipment of certain weapons, or if we, as certain senators have said, we should just shut off the funding somehow for this, for Israel's efforts to defend itself, that somehow this will lead Israel to think differently about the threat environment it faces.
The State Department said protecting and helping civilians in Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank will be at the top of the list at each one of Blinken's stops on his tour. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Joining us now to talk about this is Mark Schwartz, an adjunct international defense researcher at RAND Corporation. He served for more than 33 years in the United States Army, achieving the rank of lieutenant general. His last duty assignment was the United States Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authority. So, as Secretary Blinken returns to the region, what's your assessment of the situation in Gaza?
Well, I believe that based on some of the decisions that have been made militarily in the last week, particularly with regard to Israel pulling out, I think upwards of five of their brigades and deactivating, I think probably low thousands, but thousands of reservists is a good sign. And you are seeing a transition of the ongoing offensive in Gaza. The area that the IDF is currently focusing on is increasingly smaller as they've worked from north to south. And so they probably have assessed that they need a far less number of combat forces and combat support forces to continue on with their campaign and more precise targeting of Hamas militants as well as Hamas leadership inside of Gaza. So I think those are positive steps.
And what about Secretary Blinken's visit?
I think ideally the secretary is going to continue to discuss and emphasize with Prime Minister Netanyahu and Gallant that they are still falling well short of their responsibilities to provide humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian population in Gaza. Candidly, I think the IDF has failed miserably here, and they're running out of excuses of why they are unable to provide humanitarian assistance. They made the decision about, 4 days ago now, that they're going to allow the UK and a couple of other countries to bring in low draft maritime vessels to bring humanitarian aid into Gaza, from the Med, which is great. It's another access of which they can bring in aid. Why Israel hasn't reopened the Erez crossing or even a couple of the historical crossings in northern Israel to bring in humanitarian assistance so they have multiple supply lines to bring in assistance. I think that's a political decision. It's not an issue of the IDF and some of their commercial trucking capability to push the aid in. I know the international community, led by the United States, would proactively pre-position humanitarian supplies to include, direly needed medical assistance into Israel if they were willing to bring that in. But I think politically Israel's unwilling to do that even now, which is unfortunate. So hopefully Secretary Blinken will discuss that. And then I guess the last one, I know there's been a lot of work going on between the United States National Security Council staff, obviously Maine State, as well as U.S. Embassy Jerusalem, regarding the future of governance and security in Gaza once the major offensive operations have been completed, which is still multiple weeks, if not months away. But I think that's going to be a discussion too.
In that regard, I saw today that Israel is still saying that they want the government there to be Palestinian, and then they have some conditions. How much say is Israel really going to have when that happens?
Well, I think they're going to have 100% say in it, because the other option that they have available to them right now is they can have, a enduring without an end state of IDF presence and military governance of the Gaza Strip, which I don't think is in the strategic interest of Israel. It certainly isn't in the strategic interest of the region. And so, what I expect to see happening, and with Secretary Blinken's visit, is the two most important Arab countries that need to be involved in both the governance and the vetting of security forces for the future of Gaza is the Kingdom of Jordan, and then closely followed by Egypt. And the fact that you've seen King Hussein visiting President El-Sisi in the last 10 days here, those are part of those discussions. And you know, I say that in the order of Jordan, closely followed by Egypt, because, you know, the Kingdom of Jordan has 3 million Palestinians residing in, residing in the kingdom, and they more than any other Arab state have a vested interest in seeing the future of Gaza post Hamas succeed. And I genuinely believe, based on my time as a security coordinator and also working extensively with Jordan throughout my military career, believe that Jordan, if supported strongly by the United States and the international community, can play a vital role in the future of Gaza and, frankly, the future of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, you know, if they are empowered to do so.
Mark Schwartz, an adjunct international defense researcher at the Rand Corporation. Back to Gaza for this next story. We've been reporting about Israel's retaliatory blitz after Hamas's deadly October 7th attack and the damage it's done. Here's one of the effects. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports that as explosive weapons tear through the densely packed high-rise housing in Gaza, a generation of child amputees is emerging from the rubble.
11-year-old Noor Ma'aruf is one of more than 1,000 Gazan children to have undergone leg amputations since the conflict with Israel escalated, according to UNICEF. Her left leg was almost entirely ripped off when her home in Jabalia, Gaza, was hit by an explosion in October.
I used to run and play. I was so happy with my life. But now, when I lost my leg, my life became ugly, and I got sad. I hope I can get an artificial limb.
A generation of child amputees is emerging in the enclave amid Israel's retaliatory blitz after Hamas's deadly October 7 attacks. It's led to blast and crush injuries as densely packed high-rise housing blocks are bombed. But doctors and aid workers say Gaza's collapsed medical system is ill-placed to give children the follow-up care needed. Poor hygiene and medicine shortages spell more complications and amputations on existing injuries. At the European hospital, nurse Wafa Hamdan provides as much care as she can.
I try as much as I can to make things easier for them as a nurse, but no matter what you do, they have severe psychological problems. They feel incomplete with lots of pain. With that, we have shortages in painkillers, and they need them permanently.
Experts say children with war-related amputations will need dozens of surgeries by the time they reach adulthood because the bone keeps growing. The Strip's main prosthetic limb centre, the Qatari-funded Hamad Hospital in Gaza City, was shuttered weeks ago after being hit by Israel, Gaza health authorities say. British emergency medicine doctor Chris Hook has just returned from working in Gaza.
Many limbs that apparently have been saved will go on to require amputation, and many amputations and limbs that we think have been saved may still go on to die of the longer term consequences of all of this.
Israeli authorities have previously said they work to minimize harm to civilians. Israel's military spokesperson's unit pointed to what it called Hamas's strategy of the exploitation of civilian structures for terror purposes, but provided no specific comment on child amputees. Gaza's health ministry says the total recorded Palestinian death toll had reached over 22,000 by Thursday. That's almost 1% of its 2.3 million population.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. The conflict could be creating another supply chain shortage of goods, as most of the cargo shipping that would normally come through the Red Sea is now taking the longer route around the southern tip of Africa. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Houthi rebels from Yemen have staged nearly 24 attacks on commercial vessels since mid-November. The militants claim they are targeting Israeli-linked vessels in support of Palestinians in Gaza, Shipping companies are increasingly rerouting away from the Red Sea and Suez Canal. The UN Security Council held a meeting on the attacks Wednesday amid warnings that global food security is at risk. Khaled Kiari is the Assistant UN Secretary General.
And could potentially impact millions in Yemen, the region, and globally.
The US ambassador singled out Iran for supporting the Houthis. The US ambassador, Chris Liu, singled out Iran for supporting the Houthis. Iran denies supporting the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea. Meanwhile, analysts warn the militants could step up their attacks. Again, Michelle Wieser-Bockmann.
The Houthis know exactly what they're doing by targeting commercial shipping because it's getting the headlines and generating the concern amongst world leaders that they want for their aims and ambitions to highlight their opposition to the war in Gaza.
With shipping timetables disrupted, there are warnings that supply chain delays could last for several weeks or months. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the two explosions in Iran that killed nearly 90 people and wounded hundreds more at a memorial for Qassem Soleimani, a top commander who was killed in Iraq in 2020 by a U.S. drone. The U.S. military carried out a retaliatory strike in Baghdad on Thursday that killed a militia leader it blames for the recent attacks on U.S. personnel.
At approximately 12 p.m. Iraq time, U.S. forces took necessary and proportionate action against Mushtaq Jawad Kazim al-Jawari, a.k.a. Abu Taqwa, who is a Harakat al-Najuba leader. Abu Taqwa was actively involved in planning and carrying out attacks against American personnel. The strike also killed another Han member. It is important to note that the strike was taken in self-defense, that no civilians were harmed, and that no infrastructure or facilities were struck.
Pentagon spokesperson Major General Patrick Ryder. Iraqi police sources and witnesses say a drone fired at least two rockets in eastern Baghdad at a facility used by the Iraqi militia group. U.S. intelligence officials have determined that Russia has acquired ballistic missiles from North Korea and is looking to get close-range ballistic missiles from Iran as Moscow struggles to replenish supplies for its war with Ukraine. Gambia's immigration department has launched a manhunt for immigration smugglers after an increase in the death toll of Gambians attempting to cross the Atlantic Ocean into Europe. Some returnees are now holding workshops to tell the truth about the dangers of trying to leave the country this way. Sanu Tord reports from the capital, Banjul.
Soccer players with Kachikale United in Banjul say their last prayers for their teammates, Sharif Osane, who goes by Amphal. Sane lost his life in October, attempting to cross the Atlantic Ocean to reach Europe. Sane, together with two other teammates and about 200 others, left the Gambia via a fishing boat to the coast of Spain. A family friend, Gerard Juve, says Sani was found lying dead after a routine boat cleaning exercise.
After 30 minutes of cleaning the water from the boat, then they came back, they met him lying. They tried to see if he's still breathing, but they found out that he was not breathing, and they threw him in the sea.
Ibrahim Gassama lost about 5 friends in October. He says his country's declining economy is driving many young people to seek greener pastures.
The situation is getting harder in this country. That's why the people are, moving in large numbers.
A group of returnees have joined the Youth Against Irregular Migrations, or YAIM, founded by young people who attempted to migrate to Europe. Sena Anutot for VOA, Banjul, The Gambia.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. And finally, making your phones, your appliances, your cameras, all of your electronics smaller, your computers faster, everything more efficient, and using less energy. You know, the heart of everything nowadays is the semiconductor. And Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubens reports that breakthrough research has found a material to replace silicon to make all of that happen.
Researchers say they have created the first functional semiconductor made from graphene rather than silicon, heralding a new era of electronics and paving the way for smaller, faster, more efficient devices. Semiconductors, materials that conduct electricity under specific conditions, are foundational components of electronics. Nearly all modern electronics rely on silicon, a semiconductor which is reaching its limit in the face of ever faster computing. Researchers based in Atlanta in the US and Tianjin, China, may have found the solution to that: graphene semiconductors. The team's measurements showed that a graphene semiconductor has 10 times greater mobility than silicon, which translates to faster computing. Professor Walter Dehir leads the research.
The good thing about graphene is not only can you make things smaller and faster and with less heat dissipation, you're actually using properties of electrons that are not accessible in silicon. So this is really a paradigm shift. It's a different way of doing electronics.
Graphene is a form of carbon, just one atom thick, and yet 100 times stronger than steel. The team is hoping that their research could open a door for a major paradigm shift in producing electronics.
Graphene is the next step. Who knows what the step's going to be after that, but there's a good chance that graphene can take over and be the paradigm for the next 50 years.
Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubens. You know, just as an aside, the area just south of San Francisco is known as Silicon Valley because that's where the silicon semiconductor was invented. So maybe someday Atlanta will have a graphene neighborhood. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ongoing attacks on freedom of the press and suppression of independent media in Hong Kong by Chinese authorities are of deep concern to members of the Media Freedom Coalition, or MFC. Established in 2019, the MFC comprises 50 member states, including the United States, and advocates for media freedom around the world and for the safety of journalists. Local Hong Kong media have intensified self-censorship since the imposition of the National Security Law in June 2020, and prosecutions of media workers in connection with sedition legislation have increased. The Hong Kong authorities prolonged prosecutions of journalists like the Stan News Team and publishers such as Apple Daily founder Jimmy Lai creates a chilling effect on others in the press and media, warned the MFC in its statement. Mr. Lai was arrested and charged with two counts of conspiracy to collude with foreign forces, including calling for sanctions against Hong Kong and Chinese officials following Beijing's crackdown on activists after the 2019 pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. The 76-year-old faces life in prison if found guilty of the charges. Mr. Lai is one of nearly 300 people arrested under these laws. Freedom of the press has been central to Hong Kong's success for many years, noted the MFC statement. Curtailing the space for free expression of alternative views weakens vital checks and balances on executive power. The free flow and exchange of opinions and information is vital to Hong Kong's people, business, and international reputation. We urge the Hong Kong and Chinese authorities to abide by their international human rights commitments and legal obligations and to preserve Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy and respect for universal rights and freedoms, said the MFC statement. The members of the MFC expressed their commitment to always defend media freedom and freedom of expression and continue to stand up for those who are targeted simply for exercising their human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.